Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Blair Fackle.
The trouble with tribbles is
good enough.
Ooh, Star Trek reference, yay. you can stay.
Oh, Dan.
Listeners, I'm Blair Fackle, guest co-host this week, and with me is Dan Q.
Snowed in? You know you want to listen to Polycast.
Matt Jin.
Snow? What snow? There's this little bit of dust on the ground, but that's about it.
Makalua?
What is this white stuff that falls from the sky you speak of?
And the Mian Team.
My feedback involves spears. One of these things is not like the others.
There's no good segue, so Mac, talk.
To what?
Hi everyone, this is John Schaefer, project lead for At the Gates. You may also have played Civilization V, which was the last game I designed. At the Gates is an empire builder set in the era of classical antiquity.
Well, he's not at Stardock anymore. He went to Civ, he went to Stardock, now he's on his own and he started a Kickstarter.
Now with Kickstarter you can put an idea, or as in our case, a prototype, in front of the public and see if it's an idea that's worth pursuing.
Hooray.
How soon will it be kicked off the Kickstarter?
Well, I don't think he'd kick himself off the Kickstarter. That would be a neat trick if he could, but I don't think that's happening.
I don't know. I think he's a little overrated.
Judging by the sheer amount of vitriol being spouted on the forums, I'd say that if he found a way, there'd be a lot of happy people.
Well, he's already a happy person because it's already funded.
Yeah, I saw that this morning.
Yeah, there were enough non-haters to fund.
Sucker's gonna suck.
So I see which side Jin falls on in that debate.
Well, no, I just look at it going, okay, so he was a modder, he designed BTS, and it was good, though it wasn't, like, you know, awesome. Then he designed Civ 5, which was a bad idea. Then he went to Stardock, tried to clean up Elemental, that failed, so they made a new game, but Kale took over, and Schaefer did the scenarios for Fallen Enchantress, but those were crap, and now he's on his own, doing his own thing. So at least he can't waste other people's money. Oh wait, that's what Kickstarter's for.
He's wasting less of other people's money now?
I don't know. Good luck. Who knows? Whatever. He might find people around him that, you know, do
since
cool stuff.
That would be great.
Civ Panzer General, so this looks like Roman Panzer General.
If he can manage a good game, I mean, then, all the better. Well, I don't think so, but I wouldn't have a problem if At the Gates turned out to be a really great game. And I'm not holding my breath for it.
And that is kind of the question is, you know, how realistic is it to expect greatness out of a $40,000 budget?
Yeah, I was going, that's a pretty low budget.
Well, it depends. He might actually have other people just already giving money, and the Kickstarter part is just to generate interest.
Yeah, he's got two other people working with him right now, and given the hours that they're putting in, they take the number of hours that they're putting in and the amount of money they're getting, they might not be making a lot of money. This is a new studio, what do you call it, Conifer?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, Conifer Games. So there's almost 1,200 people who have backed for this $40,000, and he's still got 26 days left to go. So he's already got a number of stretch goals on there at $50,000 is the first one. Then there's 60, 70, and then 85. I find it interesting in a way. I mean, $50,000, there's XML mod support. There's DLL mod support at 70, and then two new playable factions at 85. $1,000, which would bring it to 10 from just 8.
Okay, I could see that you're not going to have a lot of playable factions, given that it's all very specific to the Fall of Rome. So it's not like there was that many civilizations in the area that you can put on the map without either extending the range of the map or making pretend that something was there.
There's a 15-minute video on YouTube, which John uploaded along with just kind of a general overview in the title sequence, showing the first 15 minutes of gameplay. And even though there's a lot of temporary graphics, it's been made clear that this will not be, you know, like Civ 5 3D shiny. It's going to be 2D animations, 2D graphics, and perhaps that, combined with these three people working for very little pay, again, if you translate the number of hours, reading what they've outlined, I haven't actually watched the full 15-minute video, I'll admit, but I'm reading the description. It's very detailed. It's more detailed than a number of Kickstarters. But I think John's biggest, I wouldn't say problem or difficulty, at least when it comes to Civers, is what we've already established, which is his track record. Coming from the modding community on Holton as Trip to then part of the development of Beyond the Sword, and then Civ 5, and then what happened at Stardock, and now he's on his own, probably hurting him a little bit, but clearly, you know, in less than 72 hours, you're able to raise $40,000. I guess really the big thing now is going to be, can he actually take all of this and the 15 minutes of gameplay footage that we see, and is there actually going to be a final product? I mean, that's a big question for any Kickstarter, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what Steam is for.
Well, Steam's pretty good about making sure that stuff gets online. No, I think where more Dan was going with that is, will it, ever get finished or built?
Yeah, that.
Yeah, that's my primary concern with Kickstarter in general is, you know, as far as I know, no really major projects have actually come to light through that system yet. They're all waiting for, you know, what, early next year kind of time frame.
Well, and of course, Kickstarter is more than just games as well, although, of course, our focus a lot is on the games. I mean, I'm trying to think of the name right now. There was funding for a whole gaming console raised, and it's about to be released, and I forget what it's called, and that's
the Ouya.
It was another podcast that I was a regular on for 10 months, the TD Gaming Podcast, and we talked about that, and we often look at Kickstarter projects and whether or not it's actually going to come about and whether the enthusiasm from the people who back it, it's kind of, okay, you know, you're going to get a copy of the game, a digital and or physical copy, and then maybe some other perks for kind of being in on the ground floor, as it were, to help with the development.
Yeah, you should look at the Project Eternity Kickstarter. They had it organized with all sorts of levels. They even had good stretch goals and things. And because it's an actual company and kind of thing, you can kind of trust that they're probably going to get this done. And they'll just keep going with letters every couple of weeks telling you about different things they're doing. And like the one this past week was about how they're streamlining all their development of their graphics for the armor and everything by doing a skeleton that's like universal. So it just shrinks or lengthens, depends on, so they don't have to design the armor 6 or 7 times over. Kind of thing.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to say that, you know, Kickstarter's a big scam or something like that, but as far as a source of relevant game funding, still kind of in the early stages, so it is, to me, a very valid question. Will we see a finished product out of this?
Yeah, this seems to be the new fad for designers who don't have a studio anymore.
Or it's a fad for others. Well, big names, rather than not sitting down inside one of the giant publishers or sitting down something like Chris Roberts.
Yeah, it's the whole Star Citizen thing.
Yeah. If you don't know, Chris Roberts was the lead designers on Wing Commander, old style game, and he's back building out Star Citizen, which is a brand new one. And his whole point line is PC gaming is still solid. So he's using Kickstarter, etc., and, you know, it will get built.
Whether it'll be good, we don't know, but
yeah, whether it's any good, who knows? I'm not sure it'll be great, but he is still in there.
If he can manage his product, I'm confident it'll be pretty good. I mean, I'm the Wing Commander series, so.
Well, that's the thing. It's Chris Roberts. In this case, it's the guy, not a developer, not a publisher. It's the guy, and he's going to get the money. So, yeah, he's got quite a bit of cash. Although, in this case, and this is why I think the Kickstarter for John, to tie it right back, is more of a publicity thing. Like Star Citizen, the new game, the project itself got about $5 million. Kickstarter only kicked in $2 million. So they have $7 million, and Kickstarter is less than half of his budget. So
yeah, and I have to say that one of the reasons why I'm concerned is that this Schaefer's development staff, quote unquote, it seems like it was just interns he managed to con into this.
Oh, no, it depends. I mean, people have been around for a while that you don't necessarily know who they are until they pop up on something like this. So they could be really good people.
Well, I know at least one of them, this is their first professional credit.
Oh, well, then.
And he's the coder.
Well,
that's not necessarily a
so
bad
what?
Thing.
We have to get started somewhere.
That's true.
If
that's
the guy,
true. We've had some established coders go south on us. True. Yeah. He might be a good coder.
If he's coming from a different industry, he probably knows how to code better than a lot of game developers.
That's true.
Okay, well, fair enough. It seems to be just yet another gamble that they're going in on when the court of public opinion seems to already be trying to hang this guy.
Wait.
Well, no, I find that less of a gamble than anything else. I mean, if their producer came from not gaming, or John hadn't been part of gaming and decided to randomly build a game, then I would say that's more of a gamble. But the people writing the code, no one really cares, really. If they've had prior industry knowledge or not, it doesn't really matter. It's code.
And the negativity projected at John, visceral as it can be, from a very vocal Civ community. Because they're
sorry. I was overwhelmed.
I mean, what?
Some people are holding grudges maybe just a little bit.
Probably.
A little.
This might be, you know, a wing and a prayer for John. Who can it be?
No.
Okay.
We can complete the programming with such a small team because the same people who are doing the development are the people who are deciding what goes into the game.
You know, we've been talking about Kickstarter portion and who it is, and we've mentioned at the gates. We could go on and on and on with the description, but we won't. Just so that you know, and this is, you know, like official write-up, about John Schaefer's at the gates. It's, quote, set in the waning days of the Roman Empire, casts you as a leader of a barbarian tribe ready to fill the power vacuum left by a great power in decline. You must compete not only against other nations, but with an environment that does not eagerly feed your people and armies. The resources of the world you are constantly depleting, requiring you to move your tribe in search of new ones, or to pillage those of your neighbors, quote-unquote. And from the gameplay video within the first few minutes, we do see Attila the Hun. That Civ in there.
Well, I'd hope so. This is the fall of Rome. I mean, if there's no Attila to shove all the barbarians into Rome, then it would be weird.
We want to make certain that we do not confuse John Schaefer's At the Gates with the death metal band from Sweden by the same name. You know.
Yeah, that would be a bad confusion.
So he's taking up the Sid Meier mantle and naming things after yourself, even though that wasn't really Sid's idea. But
yeah, I kind of noticed that.
That's a branding problem, actually. His name doesn't carry weight.
Nope.
Yeah. So, Dan, the read-through that you did mentioned a few things that actually did cause me some concern. Hey, imagine you want to talk about playing the Cravers in Endless Space with random events to bring your game to a screeching halt?
Suck on my random event.
And that's exactly the point.
Still in the random events category.
I understand why he's bringing in depletion of resources, and I understand why he's bringing this random ruin effect of the seasons in, but you know, you watch any game that's already incorporated a similar mechanic, you just wind up feeling cheated.
Yeah, or the game just comes to a screeching halt, and you go, well, that was stupid. The random events in Endless Space are done fairly okay. The problem is that they have a few that are so destructive as a negative random event that the game is over at a high difficulty level. Now, if you play at a low difficulty level, which I'm sure a lot more people do, or at least the middle level, then okay, you can survive it. But at high difficulty levels, lots of super negative random events, especially two in a row within a couple turns of each other, will just absolutely destroy a game. And that takes all the fun out of it. Granted, getting like XCOM also has random events, as in the randomness of requests from your countries. Getting the, hey, can you give us something, you know, very easy to make and we'll give you, you know, $2,000-$3,000 for it in the second or third month, pretty much also ruins the game because you just hit the easy mode button and troll from there.
I think if John were here, in response to that, he would say this, which was from one of the updates on the Kickstarter. John is not here to defend himself. He says, quote, "I strongly believe that the need or incentive to adapt is the greatest strength of the strategy genre. Instead of following a single rote path, players can lay down plans, execute on them, and then alter them as the situation changes. You need both a wide array of possibilities coupled with a few nudges," quote unquote.
Well, sure, and that does sound pretty good, but is it really considered a nudge when a cold snap hits, all your food's gone, your resources get depleted, and then all of a sudden, oh, that river, it's now solid, and the Huns are at the gates?
That did. There's a difference between random events and incorporating seasons. During the winter time, Europe is freaking cold. Things freeze. Food stops producing. That's not surprising.
Don't attack Russia in the winter, guys.
Darr. For that, I'm okay, but maybe in a slightly more holistic way, like you can stockpile food from the summer month where you get extra food or something along that line.
I don't mean to dismiss the game outright already, seeing as we've got, 15 minutes of gameplay to work with. It's just these are things that I'm turning over in my head right now as I'm looking over this product.
Yeah, so maybe he'll look at it. People will say that's stupid, and he'll go, okay, maybe. It's not like he's saying it's coming out next week. So lots of true. Time to change design.
Hope is cheap. You never know. It might be a good game ultimately.
Yeah, who knows? We'll just have to stop and find out. But I don't think his name is helping.
No, I don't either.
Now, in looking at some of the estimated delivery on some of these items, like, for example, if you pledge $25 or more, you get a digital copy of At the Gates, which is $5 off the planned release price. And it says estimated delivery is next June. So it's looking like a next year title anyway.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time.
9 months-ish? No, longer. I can't add this morning.
It's February. So
that's...
So you can add a 12 in front of that. And
okay, something like... It's still... That's a really short dev cycle.
Well, it's not exactly a power game.
It hasn't been stated how long they've been working on this before they made it public knowledge either. At least I haven't seen.
Well, yeah, I guess it depends on if he worked at it at Stardock.
guys, I'm totally working on Fallen Enchantress stuff in my office.
Yeah, which could be one reason he's doing something else.
Yeah, what's with this Rome stuff, though? They're roaming all over the map. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It does look like a really old style game, though. Not sure how that's going to go over. The 90s want their game back.
Yeah, I definitely got that impression when I saw the art, which granted is, as far as gaming goes, I guess straightforward to fix, but I doubt they're going to fix it that much.
Oh no, you never know. They could literally have built out a bunch of these textures just for the Kickstarter campaign and are planning on completely redoing it. That's actually very common in the gaming industry that you do, a base level so that you can show it off. And then you go, okay, well, we'll throw all the art and stuff away and actually make the real stuff now.
Oh, yeah, like when Soren Johnson and Dorian Newcomb, then at Firaxis, they did on Civilization 4 and the prototyping. And not only the screenshots, but they also had some save games from early prototypes. And the feel from the visuals to what you were doing in the game, of course, very, very different. I realized that was, was a multi-million dollar title, but still.
I'm going back to the Obsidian Kickstarter thing, but they showed where they were working on doors, and it's just 3D thing is still just gray shapes. They haven't textured or anything, but you got the idea of how they were working with the doors and putting the maps together.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but there's one key difference between the examples that have been listed, and that's they had more than one artist.
Well, perhaps as time goes on, they will add more. Maybe.
Yeah. This is kind of the same problem that mods have. Oh, yeah, guys, we're totally going to get this done in X amount of time. But we kind of need artists and coders and everything else. And
I'm sure that the artist that they've hired, she's designing a lot of the look and feel. But between John and actually the other guy's name is Jonathan. There's a John and Jonathan. How confusing. They would probably also have input onto the graphics and say, okay, we all agree on it. Now you go do that.
Go draw that.
But they're already talking about having it so that they'll put all of their game code into a library so that they could release it to the public in the future.
We're hoping that if this library fleshes out, we'll be able to release it to the public so that other game developers could use it to create games that they'd like to make as well.
And this is in their introductory video, and I thought, okay, cart before the horse, please.
Make your game first.
Focus.
That seems to be a strange philosophy. They're willing to make the source code for their game available for other people to use for a saleable product, but they made the release of the basic code for modding a stretch goal.
Yeah.
Kind of sounds like, if they can make something that other people will use, then they can point back to it saying, hey, look, we made cool stuff, and other people use it, even if the game they're trying to build sucked or didn't really get built. So, yeah, that is definitely absolutely cart before the horse. Build your game. And then if people like it, they will use it. But
here's our code. Tell us if anything is wrong.
Yeah.
perhaps just before we move on, if you're listening to this and thinking, where can we actually listen to John talk about this? He's actually been on a number of podcasts already, including Three Moves Ahead, on which Troy Goodfellow and Rob Zachney have both been guests on Polycast before. John has been a guest on Polycast before, so it's a bit of a Polycast reunion. I'm sure they talk about that for literally no seconds at all on the show. But it's episode 204 over at idlethumbs.net. They talk a little bit over an hour, including the role of map evolution, which I think we've already touched on in part.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to come here.
Aw, why not?
Wait, who's he? I talked about three he's, so, you know, you need to be more specific.
Well, the other two might show up again, but...
Well, who are the other two? You still haven't named one.
Don't want to. The one who should become nameless.
Well, then if you don't want to, then I'm not going to pretend to care. So we can move on.
Fine.
Well, fine then.
Let's talk about something that's golden.
Well, good. It's shiny. Ooh, shiny.
It's golden and shiny and has no Schaefer.
Poor guy.
Well, definitely not coming on now.
Sid Meier's Civ 5 Gold Edition has been released, or is being released, 220202, or 20, blah, way too many twos in that release date. They should learn not to do that. anyways, it's being released at the end of the month. Or a couple of weeks from now. Either way, very short months, so whatever. Apparently has a believable world with some huge battles and religion. these are the feature list.
Well, yeah, because it's combining Civ 5 and then all of the DLC and Gods and Kings. And
yeah. Basically, you get everything except for... I'm just trying to look. You do get Spain and Inca, just to make sure that you get Inca. You get Denmark and Babylon. Weirdly listed under Civ 5 Gods and Kings, not Civ 5, you also get Polynesia, Korea, the Ancient World Scenario Pack, and the Cradle of Civ packs. Oh, and a tech tree poster.
I guess you don't get Mongolia, huh?
Yep, no Mongols for you. Everybody else got it for free. You get to sit back and get nothing.
Sad face.
But basically, you get everything. I think, is there a Civ missing from that list? Other than the Mongols, for the obvious.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No, because it does include Korea, which was the only one missing last time.
But the last time, was that the Game of Year edition? Is that the one that...
Yeah, that's the one that didn't come with Korea. Korea popped out just as Game of the Year edition came out, so apparently they didn't think it was a good idea to let you also have something that they just made in a total package style, which is silly.
Further to what Magin has said, price is to be $49.99 as a suggested retail price, and the release date, yeah, it's listed as February 22nd on EB Games. It's also listed the same on Amazon.com and .ca. I guess at one point it said February 19th, reportedly. I never saw that on EB Games' website, but that's what was indicated by a couple of posters on CFC, and apparently German Amazon, Amazon.de, has a listing for it that says the 22nd of March. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's inconsistent with the other ones, because it may not be a global release, although that's a more of a staggered release than we saw with Civ 5 or Gods and Kings, but it's going to be released at some point.
At some point, you can randomly spend money on a game that you didn't buy, but you've been listening to.
Right.
Well, maybe they want to give it to a friend and show them the addiction that is Civ. You put it all into one title, and it's just all neat, tidy, and everything. the Russian address that shows breakdown of what's included in the Steam app IDs, which we also haven't discussed on the last episode about a certain rumor of a certain something. So if you want to know what the heck we're talking about, then go listen to that episode.
Yeah, we're not going to tell you about it.
Apparently, this was added onto their site on the 14th of January. The forum thread that I found was on the 26th of January. Also, it looks like it's going to include the Mac version as well. So Civilization V Gold Edition, if this is to be believed, will also be available for Mac and presumably at the same time as PC.
It better be. Civ 5 is available on both, and you don't have to pay for the Mac version if you bought the Steam version.
Steam's usually pretty good about that.
Yeah, they have Steam Play.
Look, I'm just trying to point out a feature, you know, like some DVDs point out that they've got Dolby 5.1 sound, that's a feature. Yeah, that's great.
It's not a feature, it's a requirement. If you don't have Dolby 5.1 sound, why did you put it out?
I know, it's the fact that there's the Mac version, you might be saying, damn, that's like saying, ooh, they're advertising a car, and look, air conditioning.
Yeah. Look, but, it comes with wheels.
That would be a better analogy, yes.
And doors that open and close.
Oh. I watch it for that. I guess I should point out that it's not on Steam yet. Looking at Civ 5, they just have the Game of the Year edition. They don't have gold version. At least not on the Civ 5 page.
Well, I guess they don't need the pre-orders then, like EB Games and Amazon.com does.
Apparently not.
Oh, must be nice to be rich.
Yep.
Or it could be they were told two different dates and said, hell with that, figure it out.
This is from Gamgee. Newbie question, planes. What are they good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Mackie. I was about to say, I'm going to resist the obvious musical prompting.
I saw this topic and I said, yeah, it's going to be hard not to not use that one.
Gamgee writes, okay, I want to try and play Mongolia, but I find I get saddled with a lot of planes. Perhaps I just rolled bad, but I had no hills or forests anywhere and only a marble and two elephants near my starting city. The other time I tried to play him, something similar happened. I also got hemmed in early and couldn't build any cities to expand due to culture, and I also didn't get iron and only one horse, four. This was all within the area of my three cities. At any rate, what do I do with planes? They don't let you grow as fast, and the tiny amount of production they give just doesn't seem to matter. Do I need to have the entire area as planes for it to work out? Because a lot of the time I'll be bordered on something else like a river or floodplains, and then planes on the other side. Can I just say in preface, what the Civilpedia says about planes makes me cringe a little, which is when they say planes provide a mix of food and production to a nearby city. Okay, yeah, true. A city surrounded by planes will grow more slowly than one in grassland, but it will be far more productive. And I cringe at that last portion because it so depends on what else is around you. Because, yes, would you like to work that production by the planes? Okay, well, you need to grow. Oh, wait, you can't grow to be able to use them? Or at least not right away. So then you're kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Hindered?
Alternately boned.
He later clarifies that I only had a few river plains compared to non-river plains, so I don't know how many is a few, and he never did establish whether or not at least one of his cities was on a river. So, of course, if that was the case, then he could get himself the water mill for +2 food and +1 production in addition to the granary for +2 food. Shame he didn't have, you know, like wheat, for example, where he could have also gotten some more food. But then he says, I got hemmed on the east by a desert with nothing in it. It went on and on and on and on, and then Germany was on the other side with a tiny pocket for himself. So
Petra.
It was suggested in the thread, hanging gardens as well. Okay, so that would help for your one city. It might also help to go the tradition path, bit of a longer-term investment. But I got a little confused here at one point because he started talking about, my two human players are hitting Renaissance, and I'm struggling to get into medieval. So, although it wasn't clarified, I'm thinking, wait, this is a multiplayer game? Because, you know, I'm starting to feel a little badly for him, but I think what he really needs to do, given that he is playing Mongolia, he should really try to leverage that advantage.
If you have human opponents, why have you not leveled them?
And I realize that they're far away, but you're Mongolia. You have Kesheks, and you have the great general replacement, the Khan, which can keep up with the Kesheks. And by using those units, the Kesheks give you, you know, more promotion towards getting a great general. So then you could have, you know, multiple Khans, or maybe even start take a couple of cities, and then, I don't know, start citadelling into some of those cities, even those empires like Germany, which seem to be ahead in technology, because if they are just getting to Renaissance, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a force that reflects the Renaissance era. What's happened here is he's gotten so bogged down on his starting location and thinking, like, I can't grow my cities, I can't hardly settle any cities I'm hemmed into, to say, to move from kind of a peaceful expansion and peaceful growth to something a little more aggressive, because, you know, your land is my land, literally.
But he still has to get there first. That's the problem. Planes, what are they good for? Absolutely nothing. If they are not river tiles, then don't bother touching them, because they're useless. One food does not count even for the population that will be working it. You can farm it and get 2 food, but all you do is cover that population, and you get 1 whole production out of it. Woohoo. Basically, ignore them unless they have a strategic resource on it. That's it. Don't bother trying to waste any time working on it. And his problem really was he couldn't even grow to begin with. So if you can't grow, you're going to be slow to even get to text that would be useful for him. So he's not going to be able to do much in that particular setup. Granted, we don't see the map, so maybe there's something like blatantly obvious sitting there that he missed. But yeah, granaries, water mills, you'll absolutely need both of those if you're in a plains area, just to get that extra little bit of food to be able to grow. But blatantly ignore plain tiles if you can. Though plains do tend to have more strategic resources in them, and they could be late game strategic resources, which means that you kind of have to suffer until you get to those techs to find out whether or not they're there.
Yeah, you could have aluminum, you could have coal, you could have uranium, but you're not going to know for a while.
Yeah.
I found actually this forum topic to be a fairly interesting one. So, yesterday when I was going through them, I went ahead and read the whole thing. And I have to say, unfortunately, it does kind of sound like the original topic creator. His problem was maybe not so much the starting location, is just how passive he was playing. I mean, three cities in medieval. He said he had an honor start without having those specific requirements of having a very close neighbor or a high production area. So really, it just seemed to come down to he didn't explore enough. His social policy choices were kind of eh. He didn't have that military expansion going for him. So I don't know. It seemed like he was trying to figure out what to do, and unfortunately, it just sort of snowballed.
Well, yeah, just as a quote from him, I typically go with the honor tree, but find it harder to manage my empire if I take that. Well, yes.
Duh.
Because both tradition and liberty are about empire management, and honor is about taking other people's empires that have hopefully been managed.
Exactly. And, you know, while we don't have a map to work with, everything he's describing just screams a liberty start to me. Is, you know, plant a city and then as quickly as possible expand out of that really crappy starting area.
Plausibly. Depends on the map, but tradition can work if there's not. Like, I think the original map he talked about, there was a lot of desert and plains and stuff like that in the area, so liberty might not help much. But as other people said, start befriending mercantile city-states or maritime city-states, whatever. Basically, don't just sit there and hope that something changes, because if you're not doing something, it's not going to change.
Well, speaking of changes, he started this thread on the 20th of January, then on the 28th. All right. This time, I got a good start with them. And I'm like, wait, so there's been all this feedback on, you know, and then he just gone and started a new game. It's not so much a criticism, and it's just like, okay, we're here, we're dissecting it. I was kind of hoping someone might have asked, like, do you have, like, an old save? Like, he could go back and try this again based on this feedback, but now he's got a new start, and he's four turns from Chivalry. He's got seven cities, almost more than all the other players combined. So, I don't know, it's kind of one of those things, like, I'm reading the thread, and I'm getting, like, emotionally involved with this poster, and then I find out he's just gone and discarded it, and it's like, oh, I can't even look at you.
Yeah. Well, that's common on the Civ forum, so it doesn't really surprise me.
Perhaps in conclusion to this, I mentioned earlier about, you know, that the other players were hitting Renaissance, he was struggling to get into medieval, not only because his cities couldn't grow, he wasn't just blaming it on the plains, and the fact that he had no strategic resources to expand. He says, I got declared war on by Babylon and two city-states, and they took one of my cities I was just building up, my second largest. He did say that his difficulty level was Prince. And as far as Babylon declaring war on you, he didn't mention anything with regards to his diplomatic relations, and nobody asked. You know, like, based on what he described, it doesn't sound like there were any border tensions, but I'll have to apologize in advance if they said that they covet your lands, though.
All right, so you have some feedback from previous episodes. I guess we'll be starting with the episode 161 feedback here from Apocalypse 105. Is this 161? I thought this was more recent. Well, anyway, great episode as usual. This should be a television show. Interesting. Interesting. He had a few comments on worker replacements and improving stacks. I'll start with worker replacements. He suggests to improve automation, which I agree with. I would love to see automation improved, at least to the point where it's usable. I don't know that you would ever get it to the point where it's a valid replacement to micromanagement, but usable, please. He also suggests the possibility of replacing workers with something like a Command and Conquer construction yard, new construction options, I guess. And you can just build improvements within a certain distance of that. I mean, like I said, there are ways that you could do Civ without workers, but well, that's an interesting one.
Civ after that.
Well, see, I guess to the point-ish that he's got in there, I could see a system in Civ. It's not going to be a huge difference from what you currently have, where you can say, where you have a little checkbox and it's all like a menu thing where you go, you know, improve luxuries, improve strategics, improve, you know, whatever, make it automatically happen, and then go in jungle, add this, in this, add that, has river, farm it. Simple little things like that. And then you can feed those commands basically to the automated workers and at least get your, you know, the flavor that you usually do. But then it'd have to have such a huge list that it might get a little cumbersome. But at least a basic choice list. And then you can prioritize them. So, you know, luxuries in jungles actually get plantationed versus, you know, oh, it's a jungle, so build a trading post. But then you can't, et cetera, et cetera. But then you can keep the current automation code and just, you know, be able to feed it a couple guidelines, basically.
Do Civ 5 workers make improvements based on your governor emphasize buttons if you automate them? I know they did in Civ 4.
A little. I think I've seen more trading posts pop up if it's near a puppet, which are on, obviously, gold focus.
I see.
So it's probably a little bit there. But even still, even around certain areas, it's like, oh, you should build a trading post here. Well, no, I actually want that to be a farm. I think it also changes based on your happiness level. Like, if you can't grow because you're unhappy, they don't want to build farms. They'd rather switch it to trading posts. Even if you're going to be, you know, happy again next turn, game doesn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that you can get around that without completely changing how AI works in the game, which isn't realistic. Mm. But yeah, a checklist would not be a bad idea. And if you set it up and then save your settings, it shouldn't be that hard. But
yeah.
That's not too big a deal, but it would be nice.
As long as it's not too fine-grained, otherwise the code behind it would be ugly.
He also made a suggestion about improving the stack system, and this one I find very interesting. The best way to improve this is to only allow the same military unit per tile, so you can have a massive stack of knights, but you wouldn't be able to put anything else with the knights. I don't see this working in the context of Civ 5, but in the context of like a Civ game that is built around having stacks, this would be very interesting, because it would really add a strong tactical element to a game that it has one in Civ 4, but it's really not as strong as it could be. Whereas with this, with the way counter units are built in, you'd have to be very careful with how you moved and placed your units, and scouting would make a lot more of a difference. I've never tried anything like it in the framework of a Civ game or even a turn-based strategy, so we'd have to see how that goes, but that one could be good.
As far as stack proposals that I've heard, that one actually is probably the most appealing, just simply because it has the real notion of you have your cavalry unit, you're not going to have infantry in said unit slowing them down, really. You're going to have them, you know, moving quickly and throughout the battlefield, so on and so forth. So I have to say that makes a lot more sense tactically.
Hmm. Civ Rope style, where you can make armies of the same unit type.
Civ 3 stuff.
But I would agree, if you're going to do a difference to the stack system, but still keep one unit per turn, if you do that based around, you know, you can make a more powerful unit, like massing a bunch of knights together so that they're stronger without, you know, what exactly he said. Randomly, the best defender wipes out your counter unit. Because you can't attack it.
Yeah, I gotta say, the switch to the one unit per tile thing, that was what kept me going with Civ 5 and what kind of turned me off on Civ 4.
Yeah, I think
Civ 5 would do better if they just had more hexes. Like, the space between cities would wind up being greater. Essentially, like, you have the cities are the same size, but all the other hexes are like half size or something. So you have more unit movement between cities, and the scale makes more sense. You know, like, a city's a really big thing, and the units have more mobility. It gets clunky when you have all this spillover and zone of control. And you're like, it's really annoying to like swap units on adjacent hexes all the time and try to shuffle things around.
You don't really have to do that as bad. I mean,
it's not horrible, but I think if you had, I just think it would be better if you had more hexes like that.
Switch to octagons.
No, hexes are great. Just we need more. Well, we don't need, but it would be nice to have more mobility.
Yeah. I don't know. I prefer the one unit per tile. It's far more advantageous than the Stack of Doom, and you can get more, you know, units actually being their type of unit. So that, yeah, I actually have counters and counters. I wouldn't be horrified if, you know, there was a mini stack where you could put like two of the same types or maybe three of the same type together to create a little army. Because at some point, there are bigger armies out there.
Right.
You know, a horde of warriors should be able to take down a single spearman.
I, too, have grown to prefer one unit per tile. But if we could just do something about the interface and some of the... Well, there's the whole automation question we've had before. Mm-hmm. Like, just moving a unit? No, I'm sorry, you can't get those two units to swap. Oh, well, what if I select the other unit? Well, can I swap then? Yes, you can. It's like... Oh,
I never understood that.
That's only because one's fortified, and you told it to fortify.
That doesn't matter. You should be able to swap them if you're ordering that.
Yeah, well, I think it's to prevent people from... I think that's totally a newbie prevention.
And the game made me unfortify. What's with that, man? That's what's happening.
Yeah. No, I think that's to prevent noobs from rage, because they told somebody to fortify and then accidentally told them to swap positions. Or something. I have a feeling.
I don't think that's a defensible excuse. That kind of UI issue really needs to be worked on. And that's not like that's unique to Civ 5. That's every Civ game ever, pretty much. Unless it was not there in Civ 1, or I don't really remember Civ 2 UI well enough. But all the other mainline Civ games, the UI, in terms of things like this, it's just, it needs work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that the UI doesn't suck. In certain circumstances, it needs work.
You know, you guys kind of touched on this in a previous episode, and I agreed with the conclusion that was reached, is there's only so much dummy proofing you can do. Eventually, you do have to start catering to the notion of, hey, my player base wants to learn how the game works. They'll accept it if they mess up.
Came to us from Thander. Hey, Dan, I was thinking it would be cool if you guys could do video podcasts. This might not always be possible with the hosts in different cities, but maybe you could put the title of the show segments in the video as they occur in the audio. Also, anytime you quote a forum thread or you've written down some statistics, you could show those in the video. Anyways, thanks again for the podcasts. Now, we have had on occasion suggestions for it to be a video podcast, but that would be cameras on co-hosts, and that's it. There might have been one or two times over the last 7 years that someone has suggested that we have something else in terms of the video being shown. And it's one of those things where I look at it and say, it is possible, it is something we could do, but would it be advantageous to do? And I guess I'm saying this, Thander, because you were the first person in a long time and one of very few people that ever suggested that we go to video and also have something beyond just seeing our wonderful faces. And I also look at it from the perspective, not just that there really doesn't seem to be a lot of vocal audience suggestions along those lines, but there's also this thing called post-production.
Mm.
And it really hurts me. I like get twinge in my stomach that makes me think, oh, my gosh, because if I thought that it would be advantageous, that people would like it and use it, but I think that for a lot of people, and I include myself in this, when I listen to podcasts, I'm doing something else on the screen. I'm looking at something else. I'm using it to listen to. So I think a lot of the audience would not even see that. I don't know what the other panelists think, but it's kind of one of those things that it comes down to ultimately for the reasons that I've cited. It's something we could do, but I don't think it's something that we should do.
From a post-production standpoint, I don't think it's realistic, honestly. Mm. And part of this comes from my experience doing both audio and video editing concurrently. But we would need to, in many cases, to make it interesting and not just show us talking into a webcam. I don't see how that would make it a more enjoyable show. We would need to source video footage or screenshots of things that would actually be useful to the discussion points if we really wanted to do video well. And on a two-week turnaround, that's a lot of editing that I don't see it being feasible to consistently come up with that, especially since we often try to capture topics that are relatively current. So it would be pretty difficult to follow a current topic, source video for it, edit that in, and still get it out to you guys in a reasonable period of time as if compared to just doing the audio podcast where we can discuss things in the traditional podcast format. And then, as Dan points out, we still have a large portion of our listener base who are just preferring to do something else, or maybe they're listening to it in a car or somewhere they don't have access to a computer. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's the question of, can it be done in the style that the guy's talking about, where, you know, to go along with, say, on YouTube, the audio video. Well, basically, Dan has to make a blank video anyways to get it up on YouTube-ish, or at least fake it somehow.
It's just a static image that I have stretch over the runtime of the audio.
Yeah, so the difference there would be, say, for YouTube, when each topic starts, you would have the link to the forum and whatever you want to put in, or if there's an image or something, you can slap that in there. That is plausible. It's just, like Dan's already said, post-production already takes time, and doing that just for YouTube, because obviously we have the iPod side of things, for all the podcast, you know, ways of doing that, it would be a different post-production, because it wouldn't just be the standard post-production. So that would take up even more of Dan's time, and eventually Dan would need a full-time job post-producing Polycast.
So what you're saying is, if you guys want video, donate.
That is definitely a suggestion.
That would help. Can you also donate to add more hours to the day?
Yeah.
Achievement unlocked, yes.
But,
or technology unlocked yet? Is that possible?
But one thing I could say is, one plausible option in there is that when Dan goes and puts up the YouTube videos, he can annotate the different topic times, or when the different topics start, he can put annotations up on the screen for that. And at least you can jump between the topics. But again, a little bit more work, but as long as he knows the timing of everything, then it's not that bad.
Well, seeing as how in the show notes I already delineate not only when we start a specific segment, but if there are multiple topics in a particular segment, I note those times as well. And of course, that corresponds from the MP3 to the YouTube video, which is just, again, an MP3 it's actually uploaded in Windows Media format, and it's just a static image that's stretched across the length of the video. So if that was something that, you know, people specifically mentioned, hey, we would like that annotation, that we would use that for those people that actually look at the YouTube version, because except for when the site is down, there is a considerable disconnect between the number of views of the episodes on YouTube as compared to the downloads. It's probably somewhere about 15-20%, you know, just getting it from the website itself. But if there was a specific mentioned that people would like to see that annotation, so in that video could actually jump to those segments, that is something I would consider. So Thander, if you want to follow up and be specific to that, you know, you could be the first person to in the audience to say that that's something we would like, and I give that serious consideration. I would consider that a possibility. The others,
Yeah, too much more. I don't think people need to see us at noon on a Saturday.
No,
screw you, I'm not getting all prettied up for that.
I'll wear makeup if you want.
Okay, then, Phil, you do that.
Well, you might want to see us on a Saturday night, but, you know, that's a topic for an entirely other show.
Hey-o.
Yeah. But related.
Is this next topic related?
I want to hear this segue. Please continue.
It was Majin's idea. What's related? Go, go.
Yeah. I like this. Let's go, go.
What? It's not my idea. It's your topic, though.
Yeah, it's my topic, but you said but related. Anyway, I'm not related to Brian Reynolds, but he's leaving Zynga. There, that's my segue. Awesome.
It's related, as in somebody else is leaving yet another company.
Yeah, he can hold hands with John.
It's the week of everybody leaving.
Except the difference is that Brian Reynolds actually has a good name. And most of us were kind of surprised that he went to Zynga in the first place. And wasn't it not long ago that he went to Zynga, or at least that they released that he went to Zynga?
Because he joined in 2009, so he's been there a few years.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, he was at Zynga longer than he was at Firaxis Games, which he helped co-found. And Reynolds helped found Zynga Baltimore. If you do a search for his name and find his LinkedIn profile, which he actually links to from brianreynolds.com, that's what he currently lists. As of February 2013, he is the chief executive officer of brianreynolds.com. If you go to that site, it's just a wiki front. It reads, "This site is under construction. So far, I admit my website is a big pile of fail."
Well, there you go.
At least he's, you know, having fun with it.
I appreciate a game developer who is honest and willing to make a little bit of fun of himself. Now, on his LinkedIn profile, he talks about BrianReynolds.com saying, "What to do next? Let's find out. I'm guessing it's games." Although I have to tell you something, Brian, and this kind of goes to the part that's a big pile of fail that is your website. It's not so much about the design and the lack of content, although, of course, there's those things. He has a line that says, "Oh, you can find about my latest news here and here and here." Okay, the first link is broken. The second link about latest news is an interview you gave in 2009 to Gamma Sutra about leaving Big Huge Games to joining Zynga. So I'm not certain that qualifies as news anymore. Just throwing that out there. But he wrote, I found this this morning of the recording, an article he wrote exclusively for GamesBeat, not that that stopped from being copied on the same day in its entirety to other places, including the Zynga blog, where he talks about why it is that he is leaving. The first thing that kind of struck me about it, and he doesn't go into any detail into it, and I understand why, and I hadn't read this before, but he talks about my old studio had just been sold out from under me. I was kind of like, oh, there's a story I'd like to know more about, but I'm certain he doesn't want to go into more detail. He was fascinated by Facebook, and he thought that the prototype and iterate method of game design I learned from Sid Meier seemed like it might fit. He said, you know, in the early days, I'd hear a lot of traditional developers saying things like Zynga games weren't even games, but my own experiences playing them made it very clear that they were. At Zynga, we were making games for the true mass market, and it seemed pretty obvious to me that games for the mass market would be quite different than games for the hardcore gamer. What he has said, though, is that the challenge of creating these games has been one of the most interesting of my career, quote unquote. Maybe thinking, okay, so if you are in on this ground floor here, Brian, you were part of founding Zynga East and Zynga Baltimore, and you were, you know, were heading that studio, and you had the development and the design of Frontierville, which I guess based on numbers has been close behind Farmville. Why would you want to leave? Well, he says, "I even miss, in a funny way, the day-to-day panics of being somewhere small and new and vulnerable, and the excitement of owning a small company." And I'm thinking as a side, but with the money that you've got saved in the bank from being at bigger companies. But anyway, he does thank Zynga for, quote, "taking me on when my genre was disappearing," quote unquote. And yes, he is referring to strategy games. And kind of disappearing to me is a bit of a strong word.
They were in a strong lull.
He also says, "Thanks to Zynga for letting me make games that more people played in a single day than had played all the games I'd made in the last 20 years combined."
Ouch.
"See you around the industry." And I first thought, hey, Brian, quality over quantity, no?
Yeah, a little.
And then I thought, okay, I know there's this allure of something called money.
Right. Money is good.
Yeah, and I think a friend of mine put this the best, and he put it along the lines of, "One day I'm going to develop a Facebook game, and it's called Give Me a Dollar. I'm going to include co-op mode, where you and a friend give me a dollar."
Yeah. Might as well be.
I like this plan.
As an interesting aside, while I was, you know, doing research for this, we had talked last year about Big Huge Games, which, of course, Brian Reynolds is one of the founders of. Big Huge Games developed Rise of Nations, which was Civ in real-time strategy. And we had talked about how 38 Studios, which had bought Big Huge Games in 2009, and this is when Brian actually left to go to Zynga, that there was a fiasco, shall we say, with financing from the state of Rhode Island and default on a loan payment.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
So what happened was Epic Games kind of opened their doors, and what they said was, they were out of the ashes of Big Huge Games. Epic Games said, "We are going to have a studio that's made up of formerly mostly Big Huge Gamers and some other people that work for 38 Studios." Less than 6 months later, just on Friday, it was announced by Epic Games that, yeah, this isn't working out, and we're shutting it down. So what apparently they're giving them, it was called Impossible Games. So I guess the thing that was impossible to actually produce product. So apparently, in addition to giving the employees 3 months of severance pay, says Tim Sweeney, the founder of Epic Games, "we'll be giving the team the opportunity to form a new company with the Impossible Studios name and the awesome Impossibear logo." Wait, so in the round that is the gaming industry, another tie into something else shutting down. So I don't know, maybe when Brian Reynolds says he's the CEO of BrianReynolds.com, I don't know, maybe he'll become the founder of the new Impossible Studios. No, probably not, but, you know, I'd throw that out there.
Well, they did say in the thread that he had been quoted saying that tablets and mobile were doing a strategy-style renaissance so that he might get his nose into that sort of thing. But it did say that he kind of wanted to do his own thing for a bit. Maybe it's a renaissance of old-time strategy game developers all going, screw you, publishers. You all think strategy is a dead genre. We'll make it ourselves. And then you get no money.
We have seen big names getting inspired by people coming, quote-unquote, out of the woodwork. Peter Molyneux left Lionhead Studios and Microsoft because he saw what happened with Minecraft. He wanted to go back to that kind of studio and have that kind of control. So yeah. Who knows what Brian Reynolds is going to be up to next.
All cool development comes out of not big names.
Not having to answer to your corporate masters.
Yeah.
Now, Zynga released an official statement to confirm that he had left and saying that we appreciate Brian's contribution and we're proud of the deep bench of creative leaders who are leading the next wave of game innovation at Zynga. We wish Brian the best in his next chapter. And I'm thinking, deep bench of creative leaders? Where did that come from?
You have that and you have, what?
Didn't they just reorganize?
Just been watching a lot of sports. It sounds good.
Yeah.
Troubles at Zynga. Joystick mentions the departure is the latest bad milestone consisting of financial losses, game closures, and executive departures at the company. Let's just see. Summarize. October of last year, Zynga lays off 5% of its workforce and closes its Boston studio and significantly reduces staff in another one. The next day, Zynga reports a loss of almost $53 million compared with a profit of $12.5 million the year before.
Mm-hmm.
In November, the chief executive officer resigns to take a senior finance position at Facebook. Oh, it gets better. The former chief financial officer, who was demoted when the outgoing CFO joined Zynga in 2010, goes back into his previous role along with his current position as chief accounting officer. And the chief operations officer was named too last November. This was kind of a good thing because they'd been without a chief operations officer since August.
Well, you really don't need some of these people.
Well, anyway, then they shut down Zynga Japan. As of January, it was announced in December. They pulled the plug on 11 of its games back in January. And then, also in January, JP Morgan sold off like 4.1 million shares. So now its ownership in the company is now less than half of 1% from 6.7%. So, yeah, Zynga's been battered a little bit in the last 6 months or so.
Well, as people realize, no. You shouldn't be making money off that type of crap game on Facebook.
So really what it comes down to is that, yes, Brian Reynolds might want some more self-determination. Yes, working for a publicly traded company is really, really crappy. But really, it's that when a ship sinks, sensible folk run for the lifeboat.
Yeah. That's pretty much what it comes down to. But I think there was the bit of the nail on the head earlier. We might be having a renaissance of PC game designers leaving big publishers or leaving people who bought them for a while to go do their own thing and do a bit of a renaissance on PC games.
And I hope it works. I mean, you're seeing it as well in the point-and-click adventure genre. I mean, the Walking Dead game did pretty well, as far as I know, and I enjoyed it.
There's also infrastructure there now. Like, just use Steam. Steam's good for small developers. You don't need a publisher.
Right, especially with that Greenlight system they've introduced.
Yeah. And then you can make a crap ton of money.
If you make a game that's popular.
Well, yeah.
It doesn't have to be good.
It doesn't have to be good.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Well then, Thank you for joining us on Polycast episode 166. This is the Mian team, and today I was joined by regular co-hosts Dan Quick.
Polycast is ambidextrous.
Mejin.
Hammering up the noobs.
Makalua.
I have no witty comment. Sorry.
And guest co-host Chris.
Thanks. This is Blower Falcle signing off.
Recorded February 9th, 2013. At the Gates sound clips copyright Conifer Games. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.